From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Geobiologist Hope Jaron has written a powerful new memoir that will teach you plenty about life on Earth, the plants we share this planet with, about pursuing science as a woman in a very tough American system, and about one woman's remarkable life in science. This hour on Point, Hope Jaron and her new memoir, Lab Girl. Joining me now from Honolulu, Hawaii, is Hope Jaron, professor of geobiology at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. She's author of the new memoir, Lab Girl. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Michiko Kakutani, the New York Times, calls it a book that at its best does for botany what Oliver Sacks' essays did for neurology, what Stephen Jay Gould's writings did for paleontology. That is high praise indeed. It's a remarkable, remarkable book. Hope Jaron, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
Where did you come up with the writing talent on this scale? We thought you were a scientist just moving numbers around on a page.
All I can say to that is thank you. It's something that I can do pretty easily. And so a lot of the passages that people really like were things that I sat down and wrote once. You know, I could see them complete in my head. And then it was just a question of getting them out through my fingers onto the screen. And then once I started showing it to editors, nobody ever asked me to change a word. So I think there are parts of it that just formed, and it's wonderful to see it take off.
It's wonderful to read this combination of your own personal story, very, very personal story, and a kind of masterclass in what the mechanics of the biological, the botanical world. It's just fantastic. I wish you'd just describe for us, just place us in your world for a minute. You're very lab-oriented. Describe where your lab is there in Honolulu, the surrounding, and what goes on in your lab. If we came to your lab, what would be going on around us, Hope?
Well, it's funny because you'd see a lot of machines, a lot of clear plexiglass boxes, and inside of them would be tiny, tiny little plants. And a little bit like the neonatal ICU in terms of just the look of the equipment. What we do is these are actually very high-tech gardens, and we can grow plants in these little chambers where we can control everything. We can change the greenhouse gas content and the temperature and the light and sort of give them the world we want them to have, and then we watch them grow, and we can measure anything. That's the great thing about experimenting on plants is there's no rules. You can torture them in ways that you could never get permission to do to anything with a backbone. And so we can stress them, or we can give them luxury conditions, or we can imagine a world and then watch to see how a plant experiences it.
Why do you do that? Why would you torture a plant? What are you looking to learn?
Right, exactly. So plants are three things to humans: food, medicine, and wood. They're at the beginning and at the middle and at the end of every human endeavor. And they're also tied to the world in ways that we're not, in that they gain their resources from sort of the bare bones of the planet, the atmosphere and the groundwater, et cetera. And those bare bones are exactly what's changing rather rapidly right now. Temperature is changing, and the way moisture is distributed around the globe is changing, et cetera. And it's not unreasonable to believe that that's going to have big ramifications for food, medicine, and wood. And we'd like to have some glimpse into what those ramifications might be sooner rather than later.
The lab is a place where you found what? Absorption, refuge, delight. Since you were a little girl, your dad was a physics professor, and you would join him in the lab. It's an amazing story to see just how intense things are in the lab. When you talk about high-tech gardens and neonatal units, it all sounds so crisp and clicky. But in reality, there's an unbelievable amount of passion in this book. You have to fight through poverty and psychological challenges and bare bones budgets with nothing out there to do this. it's a real work of the heart, as you describe it, Hope.
Oh, yeah. It's, you know, my very, very earliest memories were in my father's lab. He was a community college instructor, and he taught for 42 years, consecutive years. He taught all the sciences in a very small town, Minnesota college. And that wasn't just his job. It was his identity. He was the town scientist. And just like the family that ran the ice cream shop, you know, the kids were there scooping ice cream, and me and my brothers were there fixing the equipment and playing with the stuff and hanging out until he finished grading. And so it was never, I thought that I would grow up and have my own lab because that's what people did. I thought that was just, I always assumed that was true. And it's still my favorite place.
I wish you'd read a little bit for us from Lab Girl about your lab. You say your lab is a place where you're guilt. Well, read for us, if you would, just a bit of how you feel there.
My lab is a place where my guilt over what I haven't done is supplanted by all of the things that I am getting done. My uncalled parents, unpaid credit cards, unwashed dishes, and unshaved legs pale in comparison to the noble breakthrough under pursuit. My lab is a place where I can be the child that I still am. It is the place where I play with my best friend. I can laugh in my lab and be ridiculous. I can work all night to analyze a rock that's 100 million years old because I need to know what it's made of before morning. All the baffling things that arrived unwelcome with adulthood, tax returns and car insurance and pap smears, none of them matter when I am in the lab. There's no phone, and so it doesn't hurt when someone doesn't call. The door is locked, and I know everyone who has a key. Because the outside world cannot come into the lab has become the place where I can be the real me.
Hope Jaron, reading from her new, marvelous new memoir, Lab Girl. What's the real you that emerges there? I mean, we get a taste of it there, but that's all the things you don't have to feel guilty about. The real you that plunges into the research and the science. What's the focus? What's the frame of that, Hope Jaron?
I think it's very much how I felt as a small child, very safe, very happy. I still, you know, something that runs through my head fairly often is when I grow up, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that experiment. I'm going to do this. I mean, honestly,
but you're already a big deal scientist, celebrated all over the place for your work, for your research.
Well, I'm also fairly old, right? So it's just having that feeling and being able to preserve that feeling all these years is something that it's kept me young, you know, in a lot of ways, and it's kept me happy. And that's the part that I love.
There are a couple things. I mean, there's much more we want to talk about in your life, but you also write about how rough it is to get funding for science in the United States these days. And you write about being a woman in the world of science. And there's one sentence jumped out at me. See, I learned that female professors and departmental secretaries, for that matter, are the natural enemies of the academic world. In science in particular, as I read you, why? What do you mean?
I've thought a lot about that. It's a difficult relationship to navigate.
Why? You're smart, you're accomplished, you're super educated, you've got breakthroughs all over the place. Seems like that's exactly what academia should be.
A life in science really separates you from other women. And I can't, it's hard to put into words. Just writing this book and dealing with publishing has brought women into my life in a way that has never been true for me.
You mean because your department would be male-dominated or separated? How? Why?
Listen, my education was male-dominated from the first moment you enter that classroom in college. You don't move through the world of women in the same way that you would if you were studying journalism or elementary school education or nursing or any of the great professions that women have built. And I think, you know, both secretaries and female professors are just not very used to to dealing with women. And it shows in the awkwardness of those interactions. And I'm not good at those interactions, let's just admit it.
Are you past the point where that matters now? Are you accomplished and senior and tenured and established enough with your own lab that gender politics are behind you?
No. No. There's different issues that come into play. And in fact, I find myself retreating from the professional world more and more and back into my lab. I didn't believe the system when it told me I was garbage. And so I'm not going to believe it when it starts telling me I'm a genius, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's like, I don't know, this will all come out in the wash. And I really don't, I just love to be in the lab with the people I love doing what I love. And that's the reward. That's all I want from every day in the lab is one more day.
Hope Jiren, please stand by in Honolulu, Hawaii, at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. It's great to have you with us today. The new memoir is Lab Girl, and it's an incredible investigation of what it takes to do science in this country now, to do it as a woman, and of the life of one woman in the thick of it, enthralled by it, Hope Jiren. You can join us. Are you out there building a career in science and research? What does it take in terms of background, education, personality, drive, gender? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK, the Tree Song Violin Concerto. We'll talk more about plants when we come back, by John Williams. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about a remarkable woman's life in science, the passion, the struggles, the breakthroughs of a gifted scientist's hard road and success, what it takes for any scientist in our American system to make it these days, what it takes for a woman. Hope Jiren tells us a lot about that and the natural world, the world of trees and plants and more, in her fabulous new memoir. It is called Lab Girl. Hope, can you put your lens on the biological, the botanical world with us for just a second, and how you see it. You describe this deep connection to the research around plants and trees, but also a deep awareness of the sort of limitless otherness of these creatures, these living things. When you look out at a forest, what do you see?
Let's see. Well, I see the green. And that's important. I mean, I think we get to a point where we don't see green anyway. It's amazing because I talk to people and I think so many people have a special tree from their childhood. Some tree that they remember being in their lives, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And we get away from that. But you bring it up and it's amazing. People come forward and tell me about their trees.
Oh, yeah. My spirit tree. I can take you right to it.
And feel so much joy in sharing that. And then we learn, you know, people get caught up in each other and we move away from really seeing the green around us, except for, you know, folks that live very close to the land. You know, you do hear that special connection. But I think by studying plants, by spending a lot of time studying plants is that I've kept that connection. And just by pointing it out, I think you can reawaken that deep wonder that people often have carried with them, sort of dormant, waiting for the right conditions.
And yet you warn us pretty strongly against anthropomorphizing trees and other plants. They're in their own path.
Yeah. And I think that... you know, looking for ways in which they're like us, I think that hobbles the really deep joy that you can get out of considering something that's so very different from yourself, something that's been successful for 400 million years, something that can take all these things. You can't, you know, there's trees that were alive when you were born and they'll still be there when you're dead. You know, they stand in one place and watch the city change around them. Maybe in a way I can transcend all this junk, you know, between people and men and women and all this kind of stuff by focusing on something that's really other, that sort of feels like it has it all figured out.
You're worried about how much is coming down. Forest the size of, I don't know, Pennsylvania or France coming down every year. And yet you seem to embrace or accept the fact that humans are going to have this sort of voracious interaction with the environment at some level, always have and maybe always will.
Right. So, you know, as a human scientist, we've got, you know, 7 billion people on the planet, and our first responsibility is to feed and shelter and nourish and nurture those people. And that has always required the exploitation of plant life, and it always, always will. But for some reason, we frame this in our minds as, you know, it's this scenario of total decimation versus absolute preservation. And the truth is somewhere in the uncomfortable middle. If we're going to deforest at the rate we're doing, we should at least have our eyes open to the fact that that's what we're doing, that we're turning over vast forest areas into farmland. That's one thing. But now we're turning vast forest areas into farmland where we grow crops and then we ferment them into fuel and we shove it in our cars and we burn it, right? Mm-hmm. So we're burning gas in gas tanks, tractors to plant stuff, growing the stuff, harvesting it, making it back into fuel and putting it into another engine, right? So it's this weird, we have these weird Mobius strips now in our environmental activities. And my job, I think, is to point them out and to communicate, you know, the absurdity in some of these propositions. Because if we're going to do it, we should at least be able to countenance exactly the magnitude of what we're doing, is my position.
Especially when you consider what plants do to get established on this planet, the risks they take to grow up one at a time. You've got a little, I hope you'll do a reading for us there about when a plant, when a seed finally opens up and when it begins to root, the stakes for a tree, when at the moment this happens. I wonder if you could take us in and read a little bit from Lab Girl.
You bet. No risk is more terrifying than that taken by the first root. A lucky root will eventually find water, but its first job is to anchor an embryo and forever end its mobile phase, however passive that mobility was. Once the first root is extended, the plant will never again enjoy any hope, however feeble, of relocating to a place less cold, less dry, less dangerous. Indeed, it will face frost, drought, and greedy jaws without any possibility of flight. The tiny rootlet has only one chance to guess what the future years, decades, even centuries will bring to the patch of soil where it sits. It assesses the light and humidity of the moment, refers to its programming, and quite literally takes the plunge. Everything is risked in that one moment when the first cells, the hypocotyl, advance from the seed coat. The root grows down before the shoot grows up, and so there is no possibility for green tissue to make new food for several days or even weeks. Rooting exhausts the very last reserves of the seed. The gamble is everything, and losing means death. The odds are more than 1,000,000 to 1 against success.
Hope Jaron, reading from her new memoir, Lab Girl. So there you have it, a little taste of her comfort in that lab, her deep engagement there, her sense of a plant putting out that first root. And we'll hear more about some of the trials of doing science in America today and some of the challenges of doing it at a woman. She joins us from Honolulu, professor of geobiology at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. Callers for you, Hope. Nadia is calling from Savannah, Georgia. Nadia, you're on with Hope. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for allowing me taking my call. Mm-hmm. I just want to commend you for capturing what it feels like to be a female scientist in a lab. I was a marine biologist, and I dealt with marine invert taxonomy. And all I ever really wanted to do was just give me a microscope and my headphones, and I would just take beautiful pictures of different types of inverts that were coming out of the sea during collections for different types of, like, beach erosion projects or what have you, you know. And I just really love how much you captured the feeling of that being your safe haven, the place where you could just be yourself and just let loose and just be a nerd.
Nerd power. I love it.
I mean, it's just beautiful. I'm just in awe right now because I've just never heard anybody feel. I've dealt with a lot of scientists, but not many of them were passionate because they were more in the political realms of it. Mm-hmm. But to meet other scientists who just loved being in the lab and doing the work, and you could be there for hours and get lost. Was just a wonderful, I mean, you just expressed everything that I had been feeling over the years. Like, how come no one understands this is where we want to be? We don't want to fight for the grants and stuff. We just want somebody else to do that so we can continue doing this very work that we're doing.
Oh, Nadia, you're right on Hope Jaron's wavelength, right on it. We've got a transcontinental connection here and more from Hawaii. I hope you hear it right there. I mean, that's an echo straight back to you, madam.
Yes, thank you, Nadia. That's beautiful to hear, and I know exactly what you mean. I look around the studio, and I think, what am I doing here? You know, I've got a lab. I don't know if we still have Nadia, but I'd ask her, you know, when did she first realize that these invertebrates were everything, you know, that she just didn't want to leave them? Because my guess is it was pretty early.
It was. I had a teacher who, when I was in college, who made us study marine worms. And everyone thought they were so disgusting. And it wasn't until I saw the antenna of one of the worms, and it was iridescent, and it looked like a slinky.
Yeah.
And I just was in awe of it, and I just couldn't imagine such a tiny creature that you may step on a mud flat to have such intricate parts. And yeah. Then as I grew as a taxonomist and I dealt with a lot of government agencies looking at deeper water organisms, it's just mind-blowing how beautiful these creatures are. So when you're talking about the plants and the shoots, I'm totally getting how just enamored you feel towards the type of work that you were doing.
Science ecstasy right here. We love it.
Yeah, it's really true. And I think a lot of the people I know, they have that connection with what they study, and they can't really explain it. And it's very rooted in their very human aspects. And I think when you see that in students, you know, that's the part that's going to feed you when science gets hard and when you have to learn things that are difficult for you. And, you know, and it's not people's grades in calculus or whatever that points to them being successful in science. It's that moment with that worm antenna where you realize that this thing is pulling you towards it in ways that you just can't express, and you don't want to express them. You just want more. You just want a bigger microscope so you can see the antenna better. And that's the thing we need to foster. And that's what's going to pull, you know, women into the sciences. You know, if that's the goal. I don't know if that's a goal in and of itself, but you know, that's the recruitment tool that we need to be offering is to say, you know, this is a path to meaning and to joy and to connection. It's not necessarily a job to. It's not necessarily a path to financial stability. Or
Well, can we talk about that? I want to go there,
yes,
if we can. And Nadia, I'm so grateful for your call. We've got more to get
thank
to.
Thank you, Nadia.
Yes, thank you very much. That was a beautiful exchange. A couple things. I mean, we'll talk about the money. It's such a big issue, but and I guess it's related to that. But reading your memoir, I was just blown away. I mean, you were hyper successful at every step along the way here, really, academically and Fulbrights and awards and acknowledgement. And you had your PhD by the time you were in your early mid-20s. You were a professor at in Georgia right away thereafter. And still, it was so ruggedly difficult. I kind of imagined that successful people on the science track went off into some sunlit meadow of, you know, and I know there's grants to write for and all that, but I mean, you're almost dumpster diving for equipment here and, you know, killing yourself along with your partner in crime through a lot of this, Bill Hagopian, who's been with you doing research for so many years.
Yeah.
Can you just convey to our listeners who may not be scientists, who've never been in this realm, some of the toughest moments that you describe in this book were just getting the work done and feeding yourself while you're trying to do it were such a challenge?
I remember we spent a lot of time in dumpsters. We knew where all the good dumpsters were and that the engineering building, you know, threw away this great stuff. And when we got desperate, we'd, you know, and then Bill likes to just take screws out of boards and hoard them just because why spend money on screws? We're going to need it for something else. And I think we were doing that.
I mean, you guys were sleeping on couches. He was almost sleeping in the street. You barely had a place to live. He's living in why? Why?
Yeah.
Why so difficult?
It didn't seem difficult in a way. It was, we just wanted it so badly. We didn't want to have real jobs. You know, I wasn't very stable, and I didn't think I could show up, you know, for a shift, you know, every now and again. I come from a small town where the only real industry in town is a very large slaughterhouse.
Mm-hmm.
And I never thought of my job as hard or the conditions as bad. I knew that, you know, every day I didn't have to kill a pig was a good day, right?
That's great. But reading this, let me tell you, it was hard. It may not be killing pigs
hard,
and making bacon, but it was hard.
It was hard. I remember one time we were digging through the dumpster and we were looking at stuff, and we were also really hungry. And it's not like we didn't have a couple of bucks in our pockets. We could go to McDonald's, but we were just like, oh, it's late and you don't have any gas in your car or whatever. And we found food in the dumpster. We were like, should we eat this? Do you dare me to eat? I mean, it really
were you, were,
turned
were you, or were
into
you
that.
Not a professor at that point? You were a professor
yes.
at that point.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
All right. Dumpster diving. Is that because of the way our science funding
yes.
is organized in this country?
Yeah. And I don't think people understand that, is that you can be doing science and still be, you know, one paycheck away from the street. And in fact, my lab, as successful as it is, we run out of money in August. August is a long time from now. And the end has always been, you know, within view. But, you know, you're reading Lab Girl and you're reading about Bill this time next year, there might not be either one, right? So
because of the cycle of grant submissions, and then you wait and then you hear, and maybe it's yes and maybe it's no.
Yeah, and all scientists, you know, talk about the grind. But if you really look at the numbers, there's not enough money to go around. There's not enough money to keep everybody employed doing what they were trained to do. And people's tax dollars were put into training these people to a pretty high level, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of waste right there. But yeah, if you look at the numbers, we're eating our own. The system's got to break because we keep educating more scientists, and there's no way to pay them.
Hope Jaron, please stand by. The new memoir, and it is terrific, is Lab Girl. It will take you into life, plant life, and the life of a female scientist. University of Hawaii right now. Joni Mitchell behind us right now. Hope Jaron knows trees. So did Joni. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Charge the people a dollar and a half just to see them. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paid paradise, put up a parking lot.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with geobiologist Hope Jaron about her life in science, the passion, the struggles, the breakthroughs of a gifted scientist, hard road and success, and what it takes for any scientist in our system these days to make it, what it takes in particular for a woman to make it. Sandy's calling for you, Hope, from Palm Beach, Florida. Hi, Sandy. You're on with Hope.
Hi. I had a I've been retired as a professor and researcher for the last 16 years, and I had a chance to observe the transitions from the good old days of research and science into the more modern corporate kind of atmosphere that seems to have evolved. My two comments are, first, that universities are supported generally by their endowment and their tuition charges for students and from research grants. And on the endowment end of things, donors in the old days used to give money to the unrestricted endowment, and the university could use those funds for whatever purposes served them best. But over the years, the contributors preferred to build monuments to themselves in the forms of buildings and other structures with their name on it. Unfortunately, they would give the money for the construction, but they wouldn't provide money to support the building after it came into existence. So each of the buildings had to become a profit center in and of itself, and faculty were expected to support themselves and the building through the grants they could secure.
Sandy, I'm going to take it to Hope Jaron right there. I mean, clearly something's changed here, Hope, and maybe it's putting names on fancy buildings and climbing walls. But do you have a sense of a golden age having been in American science and now some kind of desert where you're crawling along toward the next waterhole?
I've been in this business for 20 years, and 20 years ago, I don't remember things being all that rosy. I think money used to come in less restricted, but I think it benefited far fewer people. I think it was divvied up kind of behind closed doors by people that were in the loop, and that didn't include people like me. I think science is struggling with how to become more accountable. I think, and that's generally a good thing. Striving toward that accountability is now based on production, and so I have to fill out things. You know, I have to fill out something every year that says, you know, how many patents did I produce?
Yeah.
Well, I don't, you know, and very. So how do you quantify the fact that I know more every year and that I've inspired people and stuff like that?
Mm-hmm.
This is made a lot more complicated by the fact that the public doesn't really know what we do, which is complicated by the fact that we don't really tell them all that well, which is complicated by the fact that we don't really want them to know what we do because we desperately want them to believe that what we do is special. And it's not something everyone can do, right? So science is a little bit hobbled by its own insistence on believing that it's honorable and lofty and all these kinds of things.
Wait, you mean anybody could do it? We thought it was special. You're telling us it's not, and it's not honorable and lofty? Please.
No, I mean, if you read this book and you really take to heart mm-hmm. what it says, mm-hmm. you've learned as much as I could ever hope to teach you in one of my mm-hmm. classes. You've learned all the important parts. And that's something I try to bring out very strongly, is it's the intuitive parts of me that make me a good scientist. It's mm-hmm. it's things that I knew I could do naturally when I was very, very young. And all the classes that I took in the meanwhile, you know, some of them I got A's in and some mm-hmm. of them I didn't. Those were all tools along the way. But I firmly believe that what makes me a good scientist is something that's in everybody.
You said that your advice to women, not just in science but beyond, but certainly I guess in science, is thinking of all the hoops you have to jump through to get funding for your research. You said learn how to extract joy in breaking rules. What do you mean and
yeah.
why?
I think it's so important that you learn how to reward yourself in this business. And I don't know a lot about the rest of the world. I haven't spent much time in it, really.
What do you mean by rewarding yourself?
Yeah, because, the medals and the papers and the grants, certainly mm-hmm. they may not come, you know. And even if they do come, they'll never be as sweet as the rewards you can give yourself every day. And a lot of that comes with defining your job on its own terms. You know, the rewards for me are being in the lab, spending the hours in the lab, working with my hands close in close proximity to the people that I really care about. Now, the institution wants me to do all kinds of things that are not that. And so I fail to do those things because I really am very pig-headed about spending my time doing the parts that I love, that I was trained to do, spending the time with students, spending the time talking to other young people, spending the time laughing at this job. That's not something, you know, your boss wants you to put a lot of energy into. But trust me, that is what will get you through science. It's just acknowledging how absurd some parts of it are. So that's what I really advise people is learn how to reward yourself, and then you'll always stay on that right track. You'll always be working for the right thing for the right reason. You know, you might go broke. I mean, that's a very uncompromising attitude. You know,
you've done all right.
It feels like a struggle, you know, but it's a good struggle. Life isn't supposed to be easy.
and then Hope Jaron sits down and writes about life and nature in a way that's just fabulous and full of a sense of humor as well. There's a passage here. We talk about mushrooms. I just love that you say, you may think a mushroom is a fungus, reading from Lab Girl here. That is exactly like believing that a penis is a man. Every toadstool, from the deliciously edible to the deathly poisonous, is merely a sex organ that is attached to something more whole, complex, and hidden. Underneath every mushroom is a web of stringy hyphae that may extend for kilometers, wrapping around countless clumps of soil and holding the landscape together. And who knew until we read Hope Jaron writing, having fun, in her lab. Erica in Omaha, Nebraska. Erica, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just have a little bit of a background to share, and it'll lead into a question. Mm-hmm. So I'm a 27-year-old female. I got my degree in chemical engineering. I'm now a process engineer at a biotechnology company in a manufacturing facility. When I first started out in school, I noticed, you know, my engineering school was very male-dominated, but the chemical engineering field seemed to have a little bit more females. I don't think 50-50, maybe 20%, which is pretty good, I guess. And then the classes that I shared with the pre-med students, you know, the biology and chemistry, those were getting to be 50-50.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I started working, I worked in a paper manufacturing facility, very male-dominated. There were maybe one older engineer, but not even just the engineering and manager staff, but, you know, everybody else is male-dominated. But the incoming group that I was hired with was, you know, maybe 50-50 women and men.
So it's a new age. Everything's solved, Erica. Is that where we're going or what?
Well, I'm not saying it's all solved. I guess, you know, I've noticed that at my current company, you know, it's a pretty progressive company and we have the same thing, 50-50 women and men. We're all in our 20s. I guess I'm just wondering if Hope thinks that's maybe just in this field or is that happening in all fields? And, you know, I don't see it in the older generation, but maybe it's some sign of the future.
Biotech maybe going 50-50 gender-wise, Hope?
That's a great question, Erica. I love, you know, at the heart of her question, sort of like, where are we? Where are the other women? I want to know where they are. The gender ratio is changing. We still have this experience where as you walk down the path, as you get to positions of more influence and access, you see women sort of fall away, you know, statistics-wise. You find yourself in rooms with fewer and fewer women in them. I do believe those numbers are changing. It's not just about changing the numbers. It's about changing the quality for whoever's in the room. It's about changing the quality for women's experience regardless of what room they're in. And so I, you know, these programs that are designed to just sort of increase numbers, I think we need a better story of what is this really like. I mean, part of me can't believe that anybody would read this book and think, I want to be a scientist, because it's sort of like, did you miss all the hours in a small room, you know, staring at these little things?
The grind part, yes, unless you love it.
You know, but it has been interesting. You know, the other thing that Erica touched on was it's been really interesting to see which fields have had their numbers change the fastest. And I could speculate on what's drawing women better. But what I think the draw is people seek connection. They seek meaning. And I think some fields offer that better than others.
But you write here, at one point you're talking to your workmate, Bill, and you say, talking about men in science, you say, look at those guys. You write, I'm going to do this job for 30 more years, work as hard as any of them, accomplish just as much or more, and not one of them will ever look me straight in the eye like I belong here. Really? Really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
What's that about? I just don't get that.
I knew that going in.
I don't understand. That seems so antiquated. It seems like not just 20th century. It seems like, I don't know, 17th century, 15th century.
Yeah, it's, you know, I mean, I have to laugh at it because, I mean, thank goodness I don't do this job, you know, to try to get praise for it. I can praise myself, you know, because I don't know, you know, I mean, I don't know. I have, you know, back in the lab, I've got better friends than they do. I just comfort myself that way.
Sarah in Boston, you're on the air with Hope Jaron in Honolulu. Hi, Sarah.
Tom.
Hi.
So I'm a young astrophysicist at MIT and kind of in the postdoc stage. I was just calling to thank Dr. Jaron from the bottom of my heart. Just as a young woman scientist, your message not only about enjoying the beauty of science, but enjoying it from a very empathic place resonated so strongly with me. It's a message I almost never hear about science. It made me feel so much less alone. You know, I try to be the scientist I needed when I was younger for the younger women that I interact with. And I feel like you're being that scientist for me. I just want to thank you.
You're welcome. And you are worth something. And you remember that.
Yes, thank you. I will. Thank you also for your piece in the New York Times about the harassment that so many of us struggle with. That resonated with me too. I felt that if I can be something like you, this will be a worthwhile endeavor.
Well, you don't know me too well. So there's that. But it's all in you. You just remember that and hold on to it. Don't let anyone tell you how to do your job. You know how to do it.
Sarah, thank you for calling. Yeah, you wrote about science's sexual assault problem was the headline of one of your New York Times op-ed pieces. And there again, you know, one wishes and hopes would be getting past that, but you tell us we're not.
Getting past it. I mean, this is the price of moving through the world while wearing a woman's body, right? You know, for some reason, we want to subscribe to the fantasy that science is above this or is excluded from these very basic power imbalances that lead to violence, you know, that lead to really real harm. And all I've really done is stand up on my hind legs and say, it's here. And I think I get two reactions. Men like to write me and say, no, it is not. Mm. Don't say that. And women like to write me and say, oh, thank God somebody finally said that. It's so, so true. You know, and so it's been an interesting road. But I've learned in my writing that if there's something I don't want to write, if I have a resistance, if I don't want to go there, I don't want to get that out. If I force myself to and I write it down, and show it to somebody, that's the thing that goes bang, that they look at it and say, wow, somebody said it.
I love your holistic way of looking at science and maybe at biology as well. How are we doing on that front? There's so much talk about climate change. You described the research that you're doing to anticipate what may be coming. Are we headed off a cliff? Are we going to do all right?
Well, those aren't the only two options, right? I think, you know, there will still be a rock orbiting the sun, you know, no matter what
happens. That's a cold comfort.
There you go. Right. So that's one end member. I think, you know, we're looking at a scenario where we might have 9 billion, 11 billion people that we're sharing the planet with. I don't think it's reasonable to say we should not offer basic shelter and food to all these people. And so we need to look at a scenario where we're trying to adequately food and feed and shelter an awful lot of people. I'm not sure how that can happen successfully without more energy use than we use today. And so I don't think it's unreasonable to look at these scenarios where we are into a higher greenhouse gas regime. You know, you can rack your brains for how we can provide all that energy. And it's, I always say, it's sort of like a hurricane here in Hawaii. Nobody wants it to happen. Nobody wants CO2 to go up to, you know, 1400 ppm. But we've got a system in place here in Hawaii. If a big hurricane hits, we know what to do. We've studied what might happen. And I think we need to start thinking that way about climate change.
1400. Now you're scaring us. We're glad you're out there working on it. And we're deeply grateful that you're writing about it in such a humane and beautiful way, and so honestly and openly. Hope, thank you very much for the book, Lab Girl. And thank you for being with us today.
You're welcome.
Hope Jaron, geobiologist, Dr. Hope Jaron at the University of Hawaii. Her new memoir is Lab Girl. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.